ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Greetings, I'm Tom Gilson, and I'm here today with Casey Luskin to talk about differing views on the relationship of Christianity and science. Casey's the Associate Director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and he's just recently rejoined Discovery following a lengthy hiatus when, well, okay, it seemed lengthy to us. I don't know about you, Casey, but he was away for a good while, earning a PhD in geology from the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. He's also an attorney licensed in California, so he's, I would say, got a better than average background for assessing the arguments surrounding science and intelligent design. He wrote an article for Evolution News last month reviewing the Zondervan book, Three Views on Christianity and Science, edited by Paul Copin and Christopher L. Reese, with contributions from atheist philosopher Michael Ruse, along with Alistair McGrath and Bruce Gordon, who are both believers. They're both philosophers of science, yet they come at this from decidedly different viewpoints, and they come to markedly different conclusions. Dr. Gordon is a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute, by the way, which gives you at least some initial idea where he might have been coming from in this book. So, Casey, could you give us an idea of what's at stake? How fundamental are these issues? How important are they?
Sure. Well, first off, let me say that Michael Ruse and Alistair McGrath and Bruce Gordon are all very smart people. They're very good writers, and they have a lot of good things to say. I mean, I think that they're all very reasonable in what they have to say. But what is at stake here is, I think, how we search for truth. Do we search for truth only seeking naturalistic answers, or do we allow ourselves to follow the evidence where it leads? That's really what's at stake here. And we can dress up this question in very, you know, high level academic language and talk about it in very complex terms. And that's all fine and good to do. But at the end of the day, that is really what we are trying to decide. How do we search for truth?
So could you explain the three views these men offer just in brief and how they differ?
Sure. So Michael Ruse, who's a philosopher of science at the University of Florida, puts forth what is called an independence view, which basically says that science and religion are separate and independent fields or methods of investigation. They ask different questions. They speak to different issues. It's essentially the idea promoted by the paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould called the non-overlapping magisteria view or noma view of science and religion. And this is sort of the idea that science and religion speak to separate realms and they don't really overlap. It's a very safe view to promote because you never have to worry about offending religion because they speak to completely different things. They speak different languages and they never fully overlap. But actually, I respected Ruse because he doesn't promote a hard version of noma in this. Some people would say that, you know, science and religion never speak to the same issues. Well, let's say that you're a young Earth creationist and you believe that the Earth is 10,000 years old. Well, that's not my personal view, but if that was your view, well, if science says that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, well, now science has conflicted with religion. So I've never seen that the noma model of science and religion makes much sense because clearly science and religion often do speak to the same questions. It could be the age of the Earth or, you know, I don't know. There's a million things that you could talk about from both perspectives.
It's almost as if they'd say you can come to two different sets of truth that don't have to agree with each other. It seems to be a very strange view of truth, if that's where it goes.
Yeah, some people might take a postmodern approach to noma, where they say, well, I hold these two conflicting beliefs, my scientific beliefs and my religious beliefs, and yeah, they may conflict, but what's really truth anyway? And who's to say, you know, what's right, what's wrong? I'm sure that there are people out there who do take that approach. Most people who promote noma, in my experience, tend to be atheists or agnostics who are trying to basically promote what they know is sort of a fully naturalistic account of human origins, but they want to promote that in a way where they feel like they're not really offending religious believers. And if they can convince enough religious believers to adopt this noma view of science and religion, then they can get away with promoting their naturalistic creation story without offending too many people and sort of, you know, rubbing the culture the wrong way. So it's very interesting that the most ardent promoters of noma by far are atheists and agnostics who really like to promote evolution to the public. I always find that a little bit suspicious. But Ruse does not promote the hard version of Noma, and I respect that. He recognizes that maybe certain interpretations of Genesis could potentially conflict with standard views of modern geology, and so he recognizes that the hard version of Noma really doesn't work. So what I think Ruse would say is that evidence from science cannot, quote-unquote, lead us to God, because he says that is the exclusive role of revealed religion or faith. And Ruse was raised as a Quaker, so he himself, I believe, I've seen him call himself both an atheist and an agnostic, so I'm not sure exactly where he lands, but he's not a religious believer today. He's somewhere in the atheist-agnostic realm, but he does have a religious background, and I think he appreciates, you know, the importance of faith or scripture and religious teachings bringing you to a belief in God. So he definitely sees that as sort of the religious mode of thinking. And that is different from a scientific mode of thinking. I can go along with that. But he really thinks that that's all religion can do. It can't go any further than sort of maybe taking you to this sort of view of the supernatural, which has really no interaction with the real world. You know, it's great, it's wonderful. And the most that he said a Christian scientist could say, and this is quoting him, he says, that God's wonderful work would inspire me in my work and tell me that I am contributing to his glory. Okay, that's fine. I mean, no religious person who's a scientist is going to disagree with that. But at a high level for him, there's really not much more for religion and science to say to one another. So then there's the view of McGrath, which is the dialogue view. And for him, science and Christianity represent two books, which are sort of set alongside each other to inform and enrich one another. But for me, in this dialogue, it's not clear what happens when one book disagrees with the other. Who gets the final say? I think the general sense is that when you're dealing with folks who take the dialogue view, they tend to be from a theistic evolution camp or evolutionary creationist camp. And the general sense in that camp is that when science and religion conflict, guess who has to shut up? It's always religion who has to keep quiet at the dinner table and let science have the final say. So they can have dialogue until there's a little bit too much of a disagreement. And I also think a problem with the dialogue view is that you assume that whatever science has to say is always the final say. Well, sometimes what science has to say is not actually very well articulated or well developed. I was just talking to a developmental biologist, and we were talking about understanding how animals arrive at their final body plan and these ideas of morphogenetic fields. Well, and we were talking about how biologists have sort of a vague sense of how these might work, but science has a long ways to go, and maybe it'll turn out to be right, maybe it'll turn out to be wrong. But at the end of the day, science is always tentative. So if you're taking science as the final say and religion has to bow to whatever science says, but science is always tentative, that doesn't make much sense. Why should religion bow to a mode of thinking which by definition is always tentative and is never final? Of course, I think we should always listen to what science is saying, and we should always consider it. And maybe sometimes science is right, and we should modify our interpretations of scripture accordingly when we think that science has really got a solid answer to something. But the general sense I get from the dialogue view is that as soon as science says something, then religion kind of has to retreat from that territory and not say anything else. I don't want to take too much time on this, Tom, but a good example would be evolutionary psychology. It used to be that some of the folks in the theistic evolution or evolutionary creation camp, including Francis Collins, would use arguments for the existence of God, like the idea that there's a universal morality among humans, and the idea that, you know, we all have this moral compass inside of ourselves, and that seems something that goes beyond what we would expect from, say, a naturalistic viewpoint. It points to a higher purpose for us. It points to a God who put that in us. And that actually, in his book, The Language of God, Francis Collins, a very famous theistic evolutionist, cites the universal morality of human beings as an argument that really brought him to faith in God. Okay, fine. I mean, I think that's potentially a very good argument. Well, evolutionary psychology is a big thing these days. There's the big cottage industry of evolutionary psych books coming out, which purport to explain in evolutionary terms how humanity evolved its moral sensibilities, or even how we evolved religion. And so now what you see is that some theistic evolution or evolutionary creationist groups like BioLogos, they have backed away from making the very argument that brought their founder, Francis Collins, to faith. And I find that very ironic. I mean, BioLogos is very, very soft now on these sort of making these moral arguments. And they tend to back away. As soon as evolutionary psychology speaks under the philosophy of the dialogue view, it's really not a dialogue. It's really a monologue then. Now you have to let science have the final say. And that's at least my sense of how it works in practice. And so I'm a little bit skeptical when some of these folks say dialogue, because it seems less like a dialogue. It's a dialogue as long as there's no conflict. But then as soon as there is a little bit of conflict, then it becomes a monologue and religion has to shut up and let science speak. That's sort of what, in practice, that's the way I see this playing out.
And Bruce Gordon, actually, in the book, you quote him in your article at Evolution News, and the book we're talking about is Three Views of Science and Christianity. He says, dialogue is nice, and he's referring to Alistair McGrath's viewpoint here. He says, dialogue is nice, but it takes you only so far. Moving beyond milquetoast notions of mutually enriching conversations to a robust metaphysical integration of science and philosophical theology is necessary. And naturalistic explanations, he also says, are inadequate, not just outside science, but within science as well. That kind of takes us in a direction of what Bruce Gordon was saying about this.
Yeah, and here science and theology are working together to help us find truth. They are not speaking to totally separate realms. They're not just sort of speaking to each other when it's convenient. They're actually working together to come up with a solution to what is true. And Bruce Gordon, in that regard, obviously, you know, you can find theological doctrines which say that there's a creator, there's a designer behind the universe. And Bruce Gordon says, well, what does science say? Well, if you're willing to go beyond a methodologically naturalistic view, we can get into that some more later, Tom, but if you're willing to sort of just follow the evidence where it leads, Gordon has pages and pages citing peer-reviewed scientific papers and mainstream scientific papers and articulating the scientific evidence for intelligent design. And so Gordon would say that we have scientific evidence for design and we have theological views of design, and these two things are actually mutually reinforcing one another and working together to find truth. So it's a much more cooperative and collaborative view of science and religion, and which is much more robust and I think actually gets you somewhere.
Yeah, so you have the two books, but it's not like one is dominant and rules over the other. It's a genuine conversation where we learn from each other and move towards truth together. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. It's a cooperative conversation. And in any partnership, there may be some times where you disagree and you have to decide who we're going to listen to. But it's much more cooperative and much more collaborative and constructive.
And it doesn't leave out significant potential sources of truth. And if you want to find truth, you ought not to shut the door on routes to truth in advance.
I agree.
So both Roos and McGrath, according to your article, they're both proponents of methodological naturalism. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes. Yeah.
And how does that viewpoint enter into this discussion about these views on Christianity and science?
So methodological naturalism is the idea that when we're doing science, we have to pretend that there are no agents, no intelligent agents, whether supernatural or even in some cases natural, who are actually involved in changing nature and intervening in nature. Okay. So we have to pretend that there are no intelligent agents. And Roos and McGrath, they like to take a methodological naturalistic view. And I think that's really important. I mean, if you care about truth that will fit a certain narrative or support a particular worldview or not get you in trouble with the scientific or cultural elites, or maybe keep you popular in certain circles, then methodological naturalism is the obvious option, okay? It's going to keep you in a very safe position. It's a very, very safe choice to make. You're not going to get in trouble with the cultural elites or with the scientific community as long as you stick to a naturalistic explanations for natural phenomena. But Bruce Gordon points out that science does not always operate according to methodological naturalism. And I'd like to quote from Gordon real quick, because he says that there's actually a very long tradition within science of leading scientists who were not committed to methodological naturalism. He says, the scientific revolution is often portrayed as replacing Aristotelian conceptions of explanation with methodological naturalism. This is at best an exaggeration. For example, even though Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton were poster boys for the scientific revolution, neither embraced methodological naturalism. Boyle thought intelligent direction was inferable from the initial condition fine-tuning required to produce intended effects from a vast sequence of conspiring causes. Design, formal cause, and purpose, final cause, both governed his conception of efficient material causality. Newton, in the general scholium to his Principia, recognizes initial condition fine-tuning the origin and function of the of our solar system, a judgment confirmed and deepened by contemporary studies of fine-tuning for planetary habitability. The mechanical philosophy of Boyle and Newton did not repudiate Aristotle's four causes or embrace methodological naturalism. The situation in biology from 1600 to 1900 contradicts the would-be narrative even more dramatically. Design plans, formal causes, identifying species that were replaced in the natural order for various purposes, final causes, dominated biological science prior to Darwin. The historical origin of methodological naturalism as a constraint on scientific explanation is found in Darwin's Origin of Species. So what Gordon would say, and he's a philosopher of science who knows the history very well, is that methodological naturalism pre-Darwin, and you know, there was a lot of very important science. I mean, science matured to a very high degree before Darwin. So it's not like science started with Darwin, okay? That methodological naturalism was not a necessary or highly important requirement of good science prior to Darwin. Of course, things changed after Darwin, but I think this is a point worth remembering, and Gordon puts it right before us. We need to grapple with it.
That's excellent. And I appreciate your just outlining the difference in the ways that we approach science and the fact that we don't have to be stuck to one potentially, you might say, as you did say, politically acceptable approach, but we can go with an approach that's more in line with the history of science and takes us back to the beginnings.
And I think that when we are willing to take off these philosophical blinders or sort of these restrictions on what we're allowed to do in the scientific search for truth, we open up new avenues of investigation. So as I said, after his critique of methodological naturalism, Bruce Gordon goes through pages and pages of articulating scientific evidence for design in nature. And here's the reason why I would say that intelligent design does not violate the principles of science, or it does not require methodological naturalism. We can observe and understand how intelligent agents operate in the world around us, Tom. We can look at human beings and we can understand by observing human intelligent agents the kind of information and complexity that is generated when an intelligent agent acts, okay? So Now, using the principles of historical sciences where the present is the key to the past, we observe present-day causes, and then we go look at the historical record and see if those present-day causes can explain what we're seeing. And guess what? When we observe intelligent agents, that's a present-day cause. And we observe that intelligent agents produce high levels of complex and specified information. Then we go and we look at the world around us. We look at information encoded in our DNA. We look at the fine-tuned laws of physics and cosmology to allow for life to exist. We look throughout nature and we find high levels of complex and specified information. Based upon the principles of historical sciences and our observations, our knowledge of where complex and specified information comes from, we can then infer that an intelligent agent was at work. So I can do science using intelligent design. Methodological naturalism may not like that, but that's methodological naturalism's problems, okay?
That's right.
I am doing science. I'm using the standard methods of historical sciences and the scientific method to apply that and understand nature. So methodological naturalism, basically at that point, the only thing it adds to the conversation is, well, you just can't have answers that infer agency, okay? Well, that's not really adding much to the conversation when we can understand how agency works and reliably predict what we should find in nature if an intelligent agent was at work. So I see methodological naturalism just coming along and trying to put blinders on us and prevent us from seeking out certain types of answers. It's really not helping us to do good science, and it's really not helping us in the search for truth.
Right. And for this search for truth, yeah, you mentioned in your Evolution News review that questions about science and faith are crucial to how people are thinking about religion. You would also, I'm sure, add that even if you're not thinking about religion, they're crucial for thinking about truth. And you say that, or you quote, rather, Rees, one of the editors of the book, saying that religious persons need to help young people think through these questions. Again, that would not just be religious people. Can you give maybe just one or two practical ways that we can help people think through these questions at all?
Yeah, no, that's great, Tom. And I think this applies to everyone, whether you're religious or not, wherever you're coming from. I think these tips are crucial. And the first one is to think for yourself and investigate the evidence and follow the evidence where it leads. I went to public schools from kindergarten through my master's degree, Tom. I took a lot of evolutionary science, and I did that because I wanted to understand what evolution was. But I didn't just sit there in class and hear and absorb whatever was being taught and say, my teacher said it, my professor said it, that settles it, I believe it. You know, I was thinking for myself. I was going out and investigating the issue. I was reading books by intelligent design proponents. Evolution News didn't exist back then, but if it did, when I was in college, I would have maybe read Evolution News. You know, there's a lot of great resources. This podcast, want to read Stephen Meyer's book, Return of the God Hypothesis, if you want to get sort of a really, really, in one single book, some of the best arguments for intelligent design from both biology and physics and cosmology. So don't just sit there and absorb what your professor is telling you and accept it as absolute truth. Think for yourself. Maybe your professor is right. Maybe she or he is not. Go out and investigate truth and figure out for yourself what is the right answer. So for me, that would be the number one, I think, tip I would give people. I guess the number two tip is to realize that it can take some time to figure it all out. Okay, you know, we like to have these sort of Hail Mary pass arguments that settle everything. And maybe there are some arguments like that that are really persuasive. I mean, I think that the language-based code and the computer-like information processing and the machines throughout biology, I think when we look at the cell and we see all of those things, that's a pretty compelling argument that intelligent design is correct as far as the best explanation for those aspects of biology. But, you know, it may take some time to really appreciate the depths of those arguments. So give yourself some time to figure these things out and don't think that, you know, you can figure it out all in one day. And, you know, there's that proverb, I'm going to misquote it, that says, you know, you think one person is right until somebody else comes along, gives their argument, then you think they're right. Well, that is often how it goes. There's a lot of back and forth. But if you spend enough time around this debate, I think you're going to see that, at least this was my experience, and that's all I can share, is that intelligent design proponents are really engaging with what evolutionary scientists are saying. We're really engaging with the issues, whereas we feel like a lot of critics of intelligent design really are not engaging with us and with our arguments very well. And frankly, I think that you'll see that if you read this book. If you look at what Michael Ruse says, he will say, well, we cannot adopt intelligent design because it's not a natural explanation. And that I'm paraphrasing him there, but he does use that argument and he essentially adopts methodological naturalism. Well, okay, fine. But where are his actual answers to the scientific arguments for design that Bruce Gordon puts forth in his section? I didn't see them. Okay, I didn't see any specific refutations of Gordon's scientific answers. Or what about Alistair McGrath? Alistair McGrath does talk about intelligent design, and he calls it, let me make sure I get this right, he calls it at best a quote-unquote probabilistic judgment. He says design is something that is inferred from observation, not something that is itself directly observed. Such an inference of design is at best a probabilistic judgment. And I think he's correct on that point, but in science, we make probabilistic judgments all the time where we infer something that is not directly observed. So what he thinks is a criticism of ID is not a criticism at all. I mean, when I think of my own research in geology, where we collected tons of data about the nature of Earth's magnetic field 3 billion years ago, we weren't there to directly observe it. We could collect data and then we analyzed it statistically or probabilistically, and we made an inference then about the nature of Earth's magnetic field about 3 billion years ago. Okay, so science makes probabilistic judgments based upon inferences all the time. So when I see McGrath saying that there's something wrong with intelligent design because it operates like that, my response is, you just situated intelligent design squarely within normal scientific practice, okay? And so I would say, you know, look at the arguments for and against intelligent design. This book is a great place to start. There's many other books like this out there, and I think you'll see that intelligent design has the best answers.
Well, very good. Thank you, Casey. That's a great review. There really is a lot at stake here. There's a lot to be understood. I appreciate how you've laid out the fundamental issues for us, laid out some of the arguments. And so thanks, Casey, for joining us for the podcast today.
Well, thanks a lot, Tom. It was fun being on the show. It's great to be back.
And the book, again, is Three Views on Christianity and Science, edited by Paul Copan and Christopher Reese. It was released early this year. It's available, of course, on the usual online booksellers. So, for more great conversations on science, evolution, and their implications for how we view all of reality, please stay tuned to ID the Future by subscribing to it on your favorite podcast app or by visiting us at idthefuture.com. Again, that's idthefuture.com. We hope to see you here again next time. Until then, for ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.